There are way too many injuries affecting contenders around the league, and we attempt to break all of them down. We vibe check the New Orleans Pelicans, who are trending very, 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 very high, and we circle the block to see how the trade deadline has worked out a month after deals were made. That and more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. I say that sadly because everyone's fucking hurt. Welcome to No Cap Room. My name is Jake Fisher, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. Joining me as always, never injured, always ready to drop bars, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports. It's my man. It's your man. It's everyone's man. It's Dan Devine. How the hell are you?
Jake, I regret to inform you that after consultation with my physicians, I am going to be shutting it down for the remainder of the season. I have impingements in my take muscles and my analysis ligaments are ruptured. So I need some time off.
How are your Twitter fingers doing, most importantly?
I mean, they're fine. I can tweet even in a body cast. That's how it works for me. Having one of those sort of, I'll be able to speed or talk to text. We can figure something out. But we were getting ready to do a show this morning and then some stuff started happening. So let us get to the talking about said stuff.
Yeah, we are going to check in on a lot of the trades that happen at the trade deadline and kind of do a little bit of a hindsight 2020/present day evaluation of the moves that did and didn't happen for several teams. But first, the news out of Minneapolis this morning is that Karl Anthony Towns, the second Timberwolves All-Star on the season, is now out indefinitely with a torn meniscus, which fans of meniscuses injuries may recall is the same type. We it's early. We don't know exactly the type of grade and all that type of stuff of what Kat is dealing with, but this is also, of course, the same injury generally that has kept Joel Embiid out for the last however many weeks in Philadelphia. So Kat's getting second opinions and whatnot, but just first off the cuff, a pretty devastating, at least for now, blow to one of the best stories in the season, the young / kind of old / where are they in the timeline, Minnesota Timberwolves, where a lot of the timeline stuff is really just through the lens of like, this team needs to win now.
And they've been doing a damn good job of that for 4 months or whatever, you know, like 5 months. Like this is, they've already won more games than they did last season. They're heading into Thursday's games at 43-19. Tied for the best record in the West. This is the second best win percentage of any Wolves team ever, best since the Garnett season where they went to the Western Conference Finals. And Kat has been a huge part of that. You know, like the we're trying to sort of process this in real time as we're talking through it. But this was what the whole thing was supposed to be when Tim Conley got there and he swung the big deal for Rudy Gobert. The vision of this working was what has come to pass this year. If we are huge all the time, we're going to have a great defense. Kat is malleable enough and gifted enough offensively to keep the offense moving, even as a power forward. He gives us mismatch opportunities all over the place, and it creates more space for Ant, and we believe that Anthony Edwards can be like the primary initiator. You get Mike Conley to be the orchestrator, get it all together. Like, it has worked. This was a proof of concept. And Karl Anthony Towns, after all that he's been through the last several years, you know, the specific and monstrous ways in which COVID like hammered his family and impacted his personal life, the injuries he's gone through, the significant time that he's missed in each of the last couple of seasons, he was healthy. He was on the floor. He was playing huge minutes and they were winning at a level that they have not throughout his entire career. And that's been like the whispers around Karl Towns for so long. Like the numbers are always good. The production is whatever, but like, can you win with him? And mm-hmm. He accepted the idea of, I'm going to go from being our centerpiece, like literal and figurative centerpiece, to I'm the number two option on offense and I'm playing power forward and having to like chase guys around. And he was doing it and earned an all-star berth for that. And like, so for this to
happen, his arm around Anthony Edwards every second he could get to even further prove that they're best buds, and there's no hard feelings at all about him losing his mantle and tossing this baton to some 21-year-old kid.
Yeah, I mean, like, and you could understand it if he didn't feel that way. Like, I mean, it might have merited criticism if he didn't feel that way, but you would understand it. And he deserves credit for what he has done this season. And for this to be the way that the things break for them a month before the playoff, or a little over a month before the playoffs start, when they are in a dogfight for the number one seed in the West and playoff positioning with the Thunder right there, the Nuggets right there, like it's so tightly packed. And this is such a monster blow in what has been a dream season for the Wolves. I mean, the glass half full, you know, spin it forward take is, this is why you keep Naz Reid around. This is why you bring him back, even though you're spending so much money on your bigs with Rudy Gobert and Karl Towns.
To be clear, they definitely had interest from San Antonio, they being Naz Reid and XL Sports. I think the Cleveland Cavaliers were poking around there too. So he got wrapped up before free agency started. Remember, they kind of signed that extension before everything got going. I think that was with a lot of educated information, let's say, that there were going to be plenty of suitors for him because he's that good.
Yeah, and he has proven that. He's been like, I don't know if he's going to what degree he would factor into a sixth man conversation, but he's been an extremely important part of that rotation all season long. And the numbers bear out his effectiveness in moments where they have not had Rudy Gobert, or have not had Karl Anthony Towns, rather. The starting lineup, so Mike Conley, Anthony Edwards in the backcourt, Jaden McDaniels on the wing, Rudy Gobert at center. When you put Naz Reid in for Karl Towns, that has still been, like, they've still outscored teams by 20 points per 100. Really limited minutes. It's been mostly driven by defense, which often factors in opponents' three-point shooting going cold. But he's a guy he can provide some of that similar floor spacing, some of that similar playmaking, rim protection, and move his feet a little bit on the defensive end. You can at least theoretically stopgap that. The numbers have been dramatically worse with Kyle Anderson in at power forward, in part because you just do not get the shooting. You don't get the playmaking, but you don't get, you know, teams will leave him alone and then clog the paint even further, which was already going to be a problem for an average at best Minnesota offense. But then there's the downstream effects of this. If Naz Reid's no longer your sixth man, if he's your starter, then where are you getting the juice off the bench? You know, are you going to need Monte Morris, who's been great for them as a playmaker? You're going to need him to start hitting more shots. You know, is Nikhil Alexander-Walker going to need to do more shot creating? Like, there's just more questions, more knock on how do you stagger with Ant and the reserves? Like, there's a lot to figure out. And that, I would imagine, in Minnesota, they're scrambling because this is some really, really bad news to get this close to the postseason.
Especially being that the overall championship chances for this team that you were talking about, or I guess you weren't talking about the top, but what you were talking about at the top is in reflection of and respect to both Kat and Anthony Edwards is just decision making and like winning play mentality late in games that has been a real bugaboo and a growing pain for both of those guys. And these playoffs were going to be not just an opportunity for Minnesota at large to move past those deficiencies, but for, I think, Kat in particular to maybe get that monkey off his back and have some type of redemption type playoff run when you close your eyes and think back to how he basically no-showed the play-in game the year that Pat Bev was dancing on the scores table and was in and out with foul trouble against Memphis, where the Wolves took that 2-1 series lead and really had multiple chances to beat the Grizzlies. And all that stuff led to Minnesota going out and pursuing a big man such as Rudy Gobert to help fortify the front court and raise the floor of what Minnesota could be with Kat and all his talents, but also his shortcomings as well. So on like a personal human level, not just this guy's going to have to deal with rehab and whatever now, I do hope that Kat has the chance to come back and prove that, because it was going to be a major storyline of these playoffs, not just for the Wolves franchise at large and how all the cap gymnastics and decisions they're going to have to make moving forward. You know, it would have all been a lot easier if they got to the playoffs and all that stuff was smoothed out and moving in the right direction. So it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see how they move forward from here.
Just to be clear, I know I generally go to worst case scenario. It's a little window into how I perceive things and the way I respond to stuff in my life. Start giving you numbers about what happens when Karl Towns is gone. It is possible Karl Towns is not gone, right? We should emphasize that. Like, we don't, the reporting is still very much in the early going as we're recording. So I know, so there's a Woj followed up saying it's unclear how much, if any time he'll be required to miss. The framing of meniscus injury as opposed to immediately jumping to tear, it's unclear. So there's still a lot to be figured out in terms of severity and timetable and whatever. It's just, so it is possible. I mean, I hope that the result of this is that I just said several minutes of things that don't matter, because it turns out that Karl Towns will be able to get back on the court in meaningful moments and play like we've seen him play. But when it comes to knees and timetables and big guys, like, you know, I think some caution is certainly warranted.
We hope LeBron can come back and play soon as well. He did not play the final 3 minutes and 55 seconds against the Kings last night, Wednesday. He limped off the court and into the locker room with what he later called a lingering left ankle issue that's been bothering him since before the All-Star break, which doesn't sound fun to deal with.
No.
And I remember when he dismantled, I'm even blanking on the opponent now, not Oklahoma City. It was a different game before that we talked about the last time we recorded this. But we talked about his heroics and that he can't do it every night when he's 39, but when he does got it, he's fucking got it. And someone replied to that saying he still has it, blah 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 blah. No, this is what we were taught. Like, there's too many nicks and bruises that have been, it's not a detriment to LeBron. This is just, I mean, Dan, you know how it is to feel 40. It's not easy out here in these streets.
That's right. I mean, I have just like my shoulder hurts just like for nothing. Like I wake up and I'm like, whoops. And it's no good thing. And I did not play, you know, 38 minutes of high level NBA basketball. Shockingly, I think that'll surprise a lot of people that I rarely play 38 minutes of high level NBA basketball, especially with my level of explosive athleticism.
We had about 90 minutes of, I'd say, high school JV level basketball at my pickup run last night. That's what I'll say.
I mean, that's impressive. I literally had 3 beers and went to bed. But only after I did some work. The quote from LeBron last night from Dave McMenamin at ESPN, "I'll be all right," James said after getting his left ankle examined after 31 points and 13 assists in 36 minutes. "It's just my ankle. It's just what I've been dealing with before the break. After the break, I'm just managing it the best way I can. I played the whole third, sat a little bit to start the fourth, and when I got back in, whatever. It's just something that I've been dealing with." And yeah, I mean, it's not, it sounds like in the same way of my, I wake up and whoops, my shoulder's bad. Not a specific thing that led to it. It's not like he came down hard after a dunk or whatever. It sounds like wear and tear. And this is, it turns out all the minutes that it requires you, or that you have to play to score 40,000 points and play 21 NBA seasons, like maybe eventually those sorts start to add up a little bit. And so super producer John Gennaro notes in our rundown here, he's 27th in the league in total minutes this season. He's got the third most minutes on the Lakers. He's like, the workload is still there, and the responsibility that he has to bear still when he's on the court is significant. It's not like he gets to just kind of walk through possessions. So the Lakers have been on the uptick for, you know, the last little bit here. I think they've had like a top two or three offense for the last like month and a half, a couple months. Obviously, so much of that is dependent on what LeBron James can do to get them into their stuff and to create something out of nothing and be an important part of that defense with his size and his smarts. Any limitations for him loom large for a team that is already, you know, trying to climb out of the 10 spot in the West and you know, having some difficulty doing so.
Yeah, look, we got Evan Mobley out for another week now. Russell Westbrook underwent hand surgery, hopeful he can return for the playoffs. Ben Simmons out for the rest of the season. Simmons' situation is not so applicable to what I'm about to say, but it is an undercurrent and a natural element to playing this game. It is not a video game. We can see, I'm sure there's going to be tweets today all over the timeline about turn the injuries off.
Yeah, ban injuries.
It's the reality, and it's just something to be said as a reason why, one of many reasons why so many teams in the league right now are both convinced and hopeful that they are the team that will ultimately be holding up that Larry O at the end of the year, because it is so fickle. The greatest chance, the teams with the greatest chance of winning, the greatest odds of winning the title, maxes out at like 20%. That's not even a coin flip. It's way, 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 way more difficult. And you could be the Toronto Raptors in 2019 and all of a sudden be staring across the court and Klay Thompson's torn his ACL and Kevin Durant has ruptured his Achilles. You could be a team that benefits from injury luck earlier in the postseason picture that just gets you, you know, through a round in four games instead of a seven game grueling battle that leaves you withered and depleted yourself for a second round matchup or a conference finals matchup. So I think that is just, and that's not to say teams are rooting for players to get hurt, but this is a clear example to me of why so many teams back at the trade deadline were holding their chips and thinking that they have chances to win, as opposed to selling if, you know, their fan base and people like you and me were suggesting that they do the opposite, because you just never know. You really never know.
And it underscores the degree to which all this is a war of attrition, right? You know, wherever side you come down on in terms of the 82 game schedule or the way it is adjudicated and like adding in more in season tournaments or play-in things, or, you know, how they try to navigate travel and mitigate the effects of it, all that kind of stuff. Any season that starts in October and ends in June is going to be about how you survive the marathon. And the Wolves were one of the healthiest teams in the league before today. And they've been laid low. You know, all of these teams, so many of the teams that, as we will talk about from with the trade deadline perspective, so many teams have navigated significant injuries early, or they're working through them now. And every one of those can change the title picture dramatically, and then leave us all sort of trying to figure out how to put the pieces back together. And you want to be playing your, every coach says you want to be playing your best basketball at the when you get to mid-April. You also need to have as many bodies as possible on hand, because so often the difference between who advances and who doesn't can come down to who's on the court.
It seems like the Clippers have had the biggest struggles with their lack of lineup consistencies. I mean, Cleveland is still chugging away third in the East. That, you know, Dean Wade moment on Tuesday night. I was working on my Buddy Hield story in the media room. I'll be honest, I didn't really watch the Nets Sixers game I was at, because I was head down in the laptop working for the man. And then our buddy James Herbert from CBS Sports tapped me on the shoulder and was like, "Hey, did you see? Did you hear?" I was like, "What?" He said, "Dean Wade morphed into the best player in the world and beat the Celtics, outscored them in the playoffs in the fourth quarter." So, I mean, that's kind of also part of all of this stuff. Like, I thought about this. I slacked you guys on late Tuesday night when I got home, and when I finished writing and saw that Denver Phoenix was going down to the wire, I tuned into the fourth quarter. Like, part of why you spend all your draft capital on Kevin Durant and then on Bradley Beal is when Devin Booker's hurt, you still have Kevin Durant and Bradley Beal. Part of why the Cavs went out and got Donovan Mitchell when they already had three all-star caliber players is that when two of them go down, like we saw earlier in the year when Garland and Mobley were out and Donovan and J.A. kind of recreated Donovan and Rudy in Utah, and the Cavs just kept on humming, winning game after game after game. If you got a big four and you lose two, you're still pretty well positioned. So I think, you know, the Clippers, they've been 6-6 over the last stretch with the number 20 offense in the league, number 25 transition defense. They needed a late 17-4 run on Wednesday to squeak past the Rockets, which hurt the momentum of the next story I'm working on, which will be coming out today regardless. Shout out Alpi Sengun, who, if you haven't been watching too much of Houston this year, truly a delightful player and really a delightful conversation as well. So I look forward to that story coming out. But is there any team, Dan, that you're – I mean, I don't think the Nets really factor in here, although we wish Ben Simmons a speedy recovery and hope to see him on a basketball court again soon, as we've been saying for the last 3 years. Is there any other takeaways here before we get to our ad break?
Oh, just with Simmons, I think it's worth, before I don't want to talk very much about Ben Simmons, not for any, you know, there's no valence to that. It's just like, there's not much to say. The Nets statement on it says that Simmons, along with his representatives and Nets medical personnel, are in discussions with numerous experts to determine a course of action that will provide him the best opportunity for long-term sustainable health. And this is about the nerve impingement in his lower back. His agent, Bernie Lee, had recently told, I think it was Ian Begley at SNY, like, the nerve issue that he's dealing with, it's the stuff that he's been dealing with all year. And he, like, the agent took the blame, says, like, we're trying to find non-surgical options, and this is where my responsibility lies, and I'm the one to blame. Like, it's just a minefield. Backs and nerves are, you know, that is a tricky set of circumstances to try to figure out. And the fact that they're saying long-term sustainable health as opposed to, like, quickest way to get back on the court just seems notable to me. As far as, the broader injury picture here, like, yeah, I mean, the Clippers have their, with the exception of Westbrook, who hadn't really been playing all that well for the last, like, 15, 20 games, they've got their main guys. It's just about, like, can you find, rediscover the rhythm that you had when they were, you know, running roughshod over the league for 2 months. The Wolves had been in a pretty good rhythm, but they were struggling with late game consistency and on the offensive end. How much does that get reoriented without Towns? The Thunder have kind of just been consistently strong all season long. They're young, which mitigates some of the injury issues that you would have to deal with older players. But, you know, are they able to just kind of keep rolling here and put themselves in position to be that number one overall seed? The Nuggets, you know, we've seen that they have the issues of Jamal Murray. He's dealing with shin splints. Like, Michael Malone said, told reporters recently, like, we're just going to be managing that for the rest of the way. And we know when they've had Murray on the court with Jokic, they are a championship level team. When they have not, the shot creation becomes an issue. So every one of these teams is going to have these issues to sort of navigate. And it's going to make what have been already, like, really tightly clustered races at the top of these conferences even more, you know, thorny as we get down the stretch here.
I shin splints my sophomore year of high school, I think. And not fun. The way to treat that
time.
The way to treat that back in 2010 or whatever exactly the year was, but around there, was to put water in little paper Dixie cups and freeze them and then, like, give yourself circular ice massages. So I'm hoping that either technology and treatment has developed or that NBA teams have greater access to medical care for Jamal Murray, because that was A, tedious, and B, then you get, like, the little driblets dripping down your legs into your socks. It's just not, like, a comfortable...
You can't have the driblets.
Can't have the driblets, so... We wish everyone around the NBA who's currently inactive a speedy recovery. We just want to watch
injuries.
You play basketball.
Turn
them
fatigue off.
And we will speak about some rosier and sunnier situations around the league after we take a quick break and pay some bills. Welcome back to No Cap Room, where the vibes are much better in New Orleans than they are during the first segment of our show. The Pelicans, they're finding a little bit of groove. They went into Toronto on Tuesday, albeit not the healthiest or stingiest opponent, but they won by 41 points.
Still pretty big.
Still pretty big. And this is a team that, if we are talking about trade deadline reactions after we talk about the Pelicans, this is a team that really intentionally, from my understanding, did not try to do too much at the deadline and really seemed content on holding pat as they did, being that they wanted to get their roster healthy and all together and flowing and really evaluate what they've got before they make any real structural moves moving forward. And it has seemingly been beneficial to do that. They are, I'd say, as well positioned as anyone in that muck below the top four to be out of the play-in picture, out of the TM play-in push. And before we get further into New Orleans, I just want to give a quick stopover to the Raptors, because I saw there was some reaction when the Kelly Olynyk contract got reported. Like, we wrote that in our post deadline, like, what are the pieces left over here meeting for the summer? Like, the Raptors weren't trading for Kelly Olynyk as an expiring contract and giving out a first round pick and not giving him a new deal. And it just like further indicates that as the Raptors were telling teams before they traded OG Anunoby and took back Emmanuel Quickly and RJ Barrett from Toronto and ultimately got back what they got back from the Pacers for Pascal Siakam, like, they weren't looking for like rebuild returns. They have Scotty Barnes. They have identified, speaking of injuries, they have identified their franchise face and they're trying to move this thing forward along. So the fact that they went out the last two deadlines and traded for two centers who they're very familiar with, Jakob Poeltl being a former Raptor, Kelly Olynyk being a Canadian, where we just want all the Canadians back with the team above the border. I just think like the Raptors have been telling us what they've been wanting to do and who they are for a little while now. So that was just a brief little tangent, but they are not healthy. They are not really competitive at this moment. And the Pelicans took advantage of that, where a lot of teams, I think, might have played down to the competition, might not have had Trey Murphy go off for whatever it was, 10 threes and 30 minutes of action. Zion looked bouncy. I don't know, man. We've talked about the Pelicans a lot on this program, partially due to a bias, thanks to our editor, Joe Garza. But they are one of the more intriguing teams, especially when you look at, okay, were these top four teams in the West just going to run roughshod over everyone else, or will there be one team to emerge from the bottom half of the pack? And now we're starting to see cracks in that top tier, as we talked about, with Karl-Anthony Towns potentially missing some time.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for the Pelicans. We on Divine Intervention, we had Shamit Dua on a couple weeks ago and talked a lot about them and like my emotional relationship to them, during which we excavated the notion that they are either like the Western Conference Knicks or Western Conference Sixers, which I think tracks in terms of the way that I relate to them, why I find them so interesting. And this is a team that it's I think probably the deepest team in the NBA. There are more sort of formulations and constructions of lineups for that team that could be good on both ends of the floor than a lot of other teams can even, you know, scrape at. The level we've seen Zion perform at before, where, you know, all NBA, like game breaking 28, 29 point a game player, that hasn't been the guy he's been this season, but he has gotten better as the season's gone along. Also, we're talking about health being such an important indicator. Like, Zion has played a lot this season. You know, he has not had significant injuries. He's not been out of the lineup. I believe it's...
I wasn't there in Toronto, but just watching on TV, the best he's looked physically to me in a long, long time. Bounce, like popping off the screen.
Yeah, and you know, the folks that cover the Pelicans have noted that. Like, he's getting closer physically to where he had been previous to the injuries, and while also playing within the construct of the offense that they want to run, they're leaning more into him handling the ball and finding more ways to, you know, increase the number of perimeter shots that Brandon Ingram or CJ McCollum take. Like, CJ McCollum has basically completely changed his shot profile to be more of a spot up shooter, an off ball guy, a second side action creator, as opposed to somebody handling all the time. Herb Jones, has been a couple of great stories this week. I think Will Guillory at The Athletic and our friend James Herbert, you mentioned at CBS Sports, about his growth as a shooter and as a playmaker. Like, he's not somebody that's just a defense only guy. He can make things happen on the ball. He's also, I think, leading the NBA in 3-point percentage since January 1st. And so that's a gigantic...
I was talking to a Pelicans assistant when they were here last week at the Garden, and he said, every time Herb shoots, I expect it to go in, which was not what you would think about with Herb Jones previously.
No. And it's a massive, like, that's the kind of thing that turns a like sicko delight specialist into a top 50 guy in the league. You know, like, if a guy is like an all defensive team caliber stopper, and he shoots 40 plus percent from three and can beat a closeout, put the ball on the deck Like, that's a really valuable player. And the cool thing about the Pelicans is that, you know, Trey Murphy is not a stopper like Herb Jones is, but you suddenly have all these wings who are big and talented and can do different things. Trey Murphy had been shooting, slumping with his shot for a long time. That's really started to heat up. So now, like, you just have these options. And so I've used or cited this this source on our show before, Dunks and Threes, Taylor Snar's website. It sort of adjusts your offensive and defensive rating for the quality of competition you've played. By that metric, the Pelicans are has the Pelicans as the fourth best team in the league over the course of the full season. Boston head and shoulders above everybody. And then right there, like Oklahoma City right there, Minnesota, and then a gap, but the Pelicans there, like up ahead of Denver, up ahead of the Clippers in terms of like the full season profile. And so that's where the Pelicans become such an interesting team to me. There's a resume that says this is a team that is like top 10 caliber offense, top 5 caliber defense with all NBA talent that you can throw the ball to create something, and enough versatility in terms of lineup constructions to answer a lot of questions that a team could pose to you in a postseason series. And then you watch them, and sometimes it looks like that, like they're blowing people out by 40 points. And sometimes it's like, why doesn't this fit more neatly together? Why aren't you better on offense when you've got Zion Williamson, Brandon Ingram, and CJ McCollum all on the floor together? Why can't you more regularly get shooters all around Zion? You know, like, how do you, what are you better with Zion at, you know, at the four next to Valanciunas? Are you better with Larry Nance there and being switchable? Are you better playing Zion as like a point center? You know, like, there's still all these questions in terms of what are the best ways for this team to build. And I think that's going to be fascinating to see what they look like in a playoff setting, because I think that will answer some of those for us and point David Griffin and the rest of that front office in a direction of like, here's what we need to here are the moves we need to think about making this summer. But they are going to be, if you are a four seed and you got to deal with Zion and Ingram and that defense, and that is going to be a bear in the first round. And, you know, we're talking about this, injuries and matchups and everything. Like, you get a favorable first round matchup, you beat a favorite, who the hell knows how far you can go?
This is why I texted our editor and Pelicans fan Joe Garza on Tuesday night saying, send me to the Western Conference first round playoffs. Dan's got New York. We've got Ben Rohrbach up in Boston. I want to go to New Orleans, LA Clippers in the first round, or right now Denver Phoenix would be the 3-6 seed. There's going to be the first round in the West is going to be, everyone's calling the West a bloodbath. We need a different word. Just like as I was doing reading for my Alperen Şengün thing that should be coming out again today. Like, don't want to call Ime Udoka a hard-nosed coach ever again, because that's been written over and over and over again. The West is going to be a gauntlet.
There it is.
Many, many hopeful teams, and the Pelicans are right there. I mean, even like the fact that they're finally healthy, but Dyson Daniels is missing some time, is like, he is someone that I was surprised when they were in town how many people with the team were just like raving about him being maybe their best defensive player on the entire team. When you talk about Herb Jones and all these other dudes that, I mean, Najee Marshall's coming out there doing the Jose Alvarado stuff these days.
That's right.
The Grand Theft Alvarado. So
the thing, I feel like every time we talk about the Pelicans, I know we got to keep moving, but there was a point last year where I forget who they were talking about as being like the Swiss Army knife on the Pelicans, but they were talking about a player being a Swiss Army knife. And they asked Willie Green, so if that guy is a Swiss Army knife, then what is Najee? And he goes, just a knife. And like the idea of, so like just Najee Marshall is a cool, like Najee Marshall is a cool name in and of itself, but in my brain from that, he has been recategorized like that's Knife Marshall. And every time I see somebody like get into a fracas with him, I'm like, I would not want to be messing with a guy named Knife. And I don't know, he's not named Knife, but like he could be named Knife and that would be cool as hell. Like, oh yeah, who's coming off the bench for the Pelicans? Knife Mitchell. I don't know. Just think that would be pretty. Anyway, it describes a style of play and an aesthetic pretty well. And man, yeah, also I love that you framed the volunteering to go to New Orleans, Los Angeles, Denver, and Phoenix as sacrifice. You're like,
I didn't say sacrifice.
Send me out to the West.
I was raising my hand very eagerly saying, well, look, last year, first year with the travel budget, didn't really know exactly how to go about these things. We had a lot of weddings on the docket.
That's
If I haven't mentioned this publicly, we went to 17 weddings in the calendar year of 2023.
Unbelievable.
So I was looking for like as little enough miles logged. There's a lot of love, a lot of friendship. This year, different approach. I'm ready. I'm ready to be on the road. Told the partner, told the family. I'm probably going to be out of commission from April 20th until June 19th or whatever it is. And then I'm going to be even more out of commission during free agency. And really, like, don't talk to me until I'm on my plane ride out of Vegas. So I'm
from
ready.
April 20th on.
It's going to be, I guess that's 3 months. It's going to be 3 months of hoops. And that's what they pay us to do. So I'm ready. I'm ready for the challenge. I'm ready for the gauntlet. I've been training. I am here to chronicle the latest chapter of NBA championship lore. But there are plenty of players who changed teams in February to help many a contender potentially better their chances of being a team that I end up seeing on the road or in New York at some point between April and June, whatever. So we can move this pretty quickly, but I just want to kind of check in on several players and teams and kind of give our early returns. I'm sure you're going to have the data and the homework, and I'm just going to give you the feels and the intel. So first, Phoenix, they, of course, as we reported, as was pretty widely reported, had Miles Bridges in Charlotte as their primary target, but the Hornets held on to him. By all accounts, they plan to try to re-sign him this summer, whether that is to keep his value and have him on a longer-term contract that could, in theory, create more trade value, or they just want to keep him as a piece next to Brandon Miller, LaMelo Ball, Mark Williams under this new Jeff Peterson regime. Who's to say? But the Suns come away with Royce O'Neal. They traded 3 second-round picks to do that, which was a little bit more than what I believe the Nets even believed they thought they were going to get for him. But the Suns, they already sent all that capital out the door for KD and Bradley Beal. The time is now. And from the one real game I've watched of them so far, that's my sample size, with that Denver that Denver overtime battle, it just seems like Royce has fit like a glove. Of course, a teammate with KD in Brooklyn last year. He has been in many a playoff battle with Utah. And as we wrote about before the deadline, and talked about in my Kevin Durant defense piece that we discussed last week, the Suns were really looking for this type of dude, a 6'6", 6'8", type of guy who could be another small ball front court piece, but also guard down. I mean, in crunch time, he was matching up with Nikola Jokic a little bit in that Denver game. Obviously, would like the threes to be falling a little bit more, as you would like for anybody to. But sure. I think the concept has been as good as the theory so far.
Yeah, he's made 4 starts for them. They've won 3 of them. So that's, you know, that's nice. You mentioned the shooting component. He's taking more threes. Like, he's shooting more often than ever before. Like, he knows the assignment. Like, I am, like, when the ball swings to me, get it up, or, you know, beat a closeout and make a play. I think he's both. It's like 11 3-point attempts per 100 possessions and something like 4 or 5 assists per 100. Like, he's doing the job as the complimentary piece there. He's also hitting 40% from three. Like, he hasn't made a whole lot of shots inside the arc, but what they need him to do there. And then, as we mentioned, like, it's, can you give us some more defensive versatility? You look at his matchups since he's gotten there, and it's like Luka, Cade Cunningham, spent like most of his time against Houston on Şengün. Against the Thunder, he's guarding like equal parts Chet and Jalen Williams. He's going up against LeBron. He's dealing with, as you mentioned, Jokic on switches and Aaron Gordon, like playing, you know, guarding up. But then also, if you need him to switch on Jamal Murray, he'll go and do that. And he's not going to lock those guys up, but he just gives you a fighting chance on those possessions. And with the whole construction of that Suns team is like, give ourselves a fighting chance on defense so that the offense can play. And they've outscored, this is from cleaning the glass, which strips out garbage time, they've outscored opponents by almost 11 points per 100 possessions with him on the floor since the deadline. So that's, you know, it is about as good as you can ask for a non-star addition, especially as we'll talk about through some of these the moves that have gone. Like, this has been one of the rosier outcomes from a deadline move, and it's put the Suns in position where, like, if they get their main guys on the floor, now they have another weapon to sort of play off of the attention that those guys generate.
A big star move, probably the biggest star move, was Indiana acquiring Pascal Siakam. And now the Pacers have not charged up the Eastern Conference standings since that acquisition. Tyrese Haliburton has been in and out of the lineup with injury all season long, so that's been a major part of it. And I do think, from talking to Pacers people over the last couple of weeks, that, like, they were really just hoping that this second stretch of the season would be time for those two guys to meld together. So lack of opportunity has certainly prevented that. But you look at what happened in Dallas on Tuesday night, where they just detonated the Mavericks. There was, like, it was like a 7-point game, I think, with like 9 minutes to go in the third. And just by the 5-minute mark, it was a double digit no contest. And the Pacers clearly have, like, the juice. To me, the pieces make perfect sense. You can get Pascal going in short roll stuff that isn't really a short roll, because Tyrese stretches defenses out. Like, he can pull from 30. So a lot of that high screen stuff happens from well beyond the arc, like a lot of teams these days, as we've got so many guys shooting step backs from damn near half court. But yeah, I am personally giving this an incomplete grade, being that if you take Buddy Hield's word for it from my conversation with him on Tuesday night, like, the Pacers still kind of feel like a team that's taking, like, one step into the deep end, as opposed to diving headfirst into, like, we are a playoff threat, where, like, the vibes around the in-season tournament run, and Rick Carlisle at the podium was saying, like, yeah, when we have Tyrese Haliburton, we believe that we are on a championship trajectory. But just doesn't seem like that's the case this season, and they're still in more of, like, a, we would just take a very fun first playoff berth, sir, and we will take that very happily.
Well, I think the part of it, Hield is a really interesting name to mention there, because
we're going to get there. That was a tease.
Yeah. In terms of what he has brought to Philadelphia and what the hope is for him there. His exit from Indiana fundamentally changed the way that offense operated. You know, like, all of the discussions of how he would, you know, the Pacers would, like, invert actions and have their guards screening on the ball for Haliburton and then flaring out. Like, Buddy Hield was the guy that, like, a defender could not leave him alone, because if you give him a half a step to flare out, he's going to catch and shoot and bomb away from three. And so the numbers on that are really interesting. And small sample size, you know, we're not dealing with a ton of minutes just yet, but when Haliburton and Pascal Siakam are on the floor together, the Pacers are getting outscored so far, which is obviously not what you're looking for. Their minutes without Hield, they're a minus 7.2 points per 100, and their offense would rank 24th in the whole league for the season. Like, the way he organized or created space in that offense, opened things up for Haliburton, presented more of those mismatch opportunities for Siakam as a screener for him as well. They still haven't really figured out how to replicate that in the absence of Hield. I think long term, the goal is, like, that's, you know, Ben Shepherd, who's like a plus shooter with size that they like. You know, maybe as Benedict Mathurin evolves his game, maybe that's a combination you go to some more there. But they haven't really figured out how to make that work. So then, like, your number one shooter is Haliburton, which then, if you're trying to create more space and create more openings, like, you now are putting Tyrese Haliburton off the ball. And, like, our friend Caitlin Cooper wrote about this on her Patreon this week, where it's like his ball screen usage is down. He's not running pick and roll as much, and he's doing more off ball stuff. But the whole thing of, like, what made the Pacers so special offensively is Haliburton on the ball, spread shooting around him, making all these decisions, and it was like making defenses wrong no matter what choices they make. And so they're still figuring out how to make that work. Like, Doug McDermott, they hoped would give them some of that movement shooting, hasn't played a ton, hasn't been very effective when he has been there. Shepherd in and out of the lineup, also still a rookie, still figuring things out. Like, this is going to be a work in progress for them. But as you mentioned, that Dallas, it was a reminder of this is what that offense can look like. And that's what would make them a very dangerous underdog against pretty much any team that they would face in the first round, especially considering Siakam, while the overall offense hasn't been great, like, they have not, his impact has not been felt as strongly as they'd hope. His individual production has been like usage down a little bit, efficiency up, still around like 21-7-5. Like he's still that guy. If they can sort of just figure out how to get the other pieces moving in the right directions and create some of the more opportunities for Halliburton to do what he'd been doing, that can be a scary team to face in the first round.
Let's just go right to Philly, where Buddy Hield has been Buddy Hield, to your point. Shooting 42% from three last I checked. I didn't check after the Memphis game last night. But going into Memphis' surprising victory that left all my friends in the Philly group chat demoralized. I texted someone with the Grizzlies saying, "You have just turned the entire Sixers fan base against Tobias Harris. How dare you?" But like,
that was happening before that game. Happening.
Yes. In watching Buddy clips and taking an eye to him for that story, I am so intrigued by seeing him do all that stuff that you were just talking about in Indiana once Joel Embiid comes back. And I would think they'll try to reprise some of the DHO stuff that they did with JJ Redick, our friend JJ Redick, Dan Devine's friend JJ Redick, over and over and over again throughout his tenure there. Obviously different coaching staff. Obviously Joel Embiid has blossomed into far more of an offensive monster and arguably the greatest scorer in the game since then. But that's why they traded for him. They traded for Buddy with the expectation that Joel Embiid is going to be back, that even though he is on an expiring contract, he being healed, the Sixers have this mountain of cap space. They're going to have more cap space than any contending team in all the land. And they should be able to re-sign him with ease if they would like to, or replace him with another shooter archetype if they so choose. But seems like he's really motivated by this situation. Seems like he really wanted to get out of Indiana, not with any like real shade to the people there, because he did say how much he enjoyed being around that young group and him and Tyrese, while they definitely butted heads like brothers have over the years back in Sacramento and in Indiana. They had played together more than anyone of Tyrese's career. They were like the number one assist to scoring tandem last season, and they were definitely up there at the beginning of this season come the Vegas title run that they went on. So campaign, I feel like, has been basically fine and what you'd expect for your like one of three backup point guards now that they have there. But I think largely like the Sixers trade deadline was about Buddy Hield. Was about recouping the second round picks they sent out to get Buddy Hield. That was part of the campaign, Patrick Beverley deal. And it really also is an incomplete so far until we get the Sixers healthy, like everyone else healthy, because Tyrese Maxey had a like very bizarre concussion situation where he was at morning shoot around on Tuesday in Brooklyn and then determined he was concussed and like couldn't play later that night. So we wish him a speedy recovery. We want to see Joel Embiid back soon as well, so we can see Buddy Hield run boomerang cuts off of his screens and fly into wide open three-pointers.
Yeah, might sound more disrespectful than I intended to. And if that's the case, then you let me know, check me on it. But a lot of these deals, and as we get to, you know, we'll talk about the Knicks and whatever, it's like these are moves intended to be side dishes, and now you have like, this is supposed to be the main course because the main course is gone. Like you don't have the guys that these were all supposed to be supplementing. So now you need like, campaign is fine, but campaign shouldn't be playing like 22 minutes a night. Buddy Hield is who Buddy Hield is, great at what Buddy Hield does, but he's going to be a defensive target and he's not going to create much shots for other people. He can't be like the centerpiece of your offense. As you mentioned, the Tobias Harris problem, like, If you don't have Joel Embiid and you don't have Tyrese Maxey and you don't have whatever like DeAnthony Melton and, you know, go down the list of all the guys that the Sixers don't have, somebody has to just be a usage innings eater. And so that's like the goal of that is that should be Tobias Harris's job. And he just has not been up to the task and able to do it nearly at the level that they need to stay afloat. But the goal of all that is like, if you can just get any of these guys back in a major way, and obviously Embiid being the number one option there, Everybody else falls into line. But in the absence of that, everybody gets stretched too thin and, you know, you wind up getting holes poked in you.
Yeah. In the interest of time, a lot of these additions are pretty much side dishes, right? That was kind of the theme of the trade deadline. If you want to hear more about the better fit of Terry Rozier compared to Kyle Lowry in Miami, if you want to hear about Patrick Beverley's belt to ass tour in Milwaukee, you can listen to Divine Intervention with Wes Goldberg. That was a lovely episode that was recorded the other day. I think in regards to all that, like the one most interesting situation here to me is that the Knicks are right there with all these teams of just being super injury plagued, right? Like four of their starters are out. Jalen Brunson, the latest to join the pile of people on the bench. But like this, not exactly this situation, but the void of when Jalen Brunson is not on the floor is largely why New York went to trade for Bojan Bogdanovic and Alec Burks, why the fans and a lot of people in the local media were clearly asking for the Knicks to find some type of Emmanuel Quickly replacement after they sent out Quickly and Barrett for OG Anunoby. And the early returns with OG were great, obviously. Then all this stuff started to hit the fan and blah, blah, blah. To me, it has been, I've only been to a couple of Knicks games since, but every single time I've been there, it's been pretty disappointing, I'd say, but also even like jarring to see how just like not deadly Bojan and Alec Burks have been when this is kind of the exact situation, again, not entirely, but like you were trading for these guys for when Jalen Brunson was not available and in his void. Sure, Deuce McBride has been awesome. That's been kind of like a fun silver lining. And maybe he was directly responsible for the Evan Mobley ankle injury that we mentioned at the top of all this with that nasty in and out cross he had in Cleveland. But I think part of the concern for a lot of teams to not give the two first round picks and then some that Detroit wanted for Bojan last year was because of the potential decline and how good was he going to continue to be at his advanced age and blah, blah, blah. I'm not saying that's what's happening here. Maybe it's just like a needing to get settled type of thing still. But even Alec Burks, who like people would have thought was just going to be like a plug and play former Tibbs darling, like it just hasn't seemed to have been those guys haven't brought the juice that I think on paper everyone expected they were going to bring when they just changed jerseys and put on that home white in the Garden.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with Alec Burks, a lot of that is just, is he making threes or not? Like he shot like 45% from three between Christmas and the trade deadline. And then before that, he didn't. Right. Like, so if he's making a bunch of shots, then you can live with the fact that he doesn't make kind of any other things happen. Like, yeah, the Knicks kind of paid for hot shooting. Our friend Fred Katz of The Athletic is tracking how many threes Alec Burks makes versus how many layups Alec Burks makes. And right now layups are getting their asses kicked. It's a belt to ass tour for layups in that regard. Like he's made 5 layups as a Knick and 14 3-pointers, which would be fine if he wasn't missing 70% of his threes. So yeah, like you need the goal of that. And that's why when people were talking about like, would it have been worth the Knicks' while to pony up a little more, maybe, and obviously so much of this is reconstructing who was actually available and what were the price tags, but like for a younger option with more off the dribble juice instead of Alec Burks, but Burks
say DeJounte Murray, that was kind of the one obvious answer
that we knew was out. Yeah. That we knew would was out there and could be had. And so that was, so that didn't come to pass. And this is what the Knicks have. And like, you have to zoom out a little bit, as was the case with the Sixers, and say any team without arguably its 4 most important players or, you know, 4, it's like 4 members of its starting lineup and also dealing with injury and fatigue issues for other guys is going to, you know, be impinged upon. But like, yeah, you were absolutely right to point to like the Brunson. If Brunson's unavailable, or even if he's available, but when he's off the floor, they just do not have enough shot creation. Like they were generating some good looks against Atlanta the other night, but they weren't cashing them in. Perhaps that's, you know, a little bit of the wages of take 18 three-pointers a night, Dante DiVincenzo, eventually your legs get tired. And you're just hoping for the best. I mean, it's why one of the most impressive and sort of surprising trade deadline acquisitions has been Precious Achiuwa, because like,
oh, yeah.
Holy cow, he can like, but between whether he's hammering the offensive glass or creating a little bit with his face-up game or the occasional pick and pop three, like there's more to be sort of tapped into there. And he's been pretty great for the Knicks, but you're absolutely right. Like they are in a very precarious position, much like the Sixers, where they're in that clump in the middle of the pack in the Eastern Conference. And, you know, this slide continues, and they've been like one of the worst teams in the league since the deadline with all the injuries. Bad on defense, can't generate offense without Brunson. You are you're riding kind of a razor thin line between staying in that top six or finding yourself down in seventh and eighth. And like, there's only so far you can drop given what the, you know, where the bottom of the play-in race is in the East. But either way, like you reach a point where, when do we get Julius Randle back? When do we get OG Anunoby back? What does Mitchell Robinson look like when he gets back? And then how far of a climb do you have to get to? There is a world where a full strength Knicks team is a really tough matchup for most of the favorites in the East, but that world is getting further and further away the further away we are from seeing a full strength Knicks team. And this is just, you know, like you thought you had one thing and then it turned out you didn't. And that's a lot of teams are feeling that kind of pain right now.
Is there one last trade deadline acquisition you want to talk about, or would you like to hear a tale about the dentist before we get out of here?
I'm going to say one line and then I want to hear the dentist story. Gordon Hayward has made 10 shots since he got to Oklahoma City. So the thing I wrote where I was like, winner, Oklahoma City Thunder. They got this perfect piece for them. Maybe not so perfect. Gordon, you know, hope springs eternal, but it's looking pretty rough out there, buddy. You know, rest up, get ready, because you're more will be required of you, sir. Tell me about the dentist.
So a couple weeks back, it's like late January, I want to say, I went to a friend's birthday party, a friend's 30th birthday party, who doesn't even live in New York, but he's just such a gregarious individual that while he was here, some of his friends decided to throw a like smaller 30th birthday party for him.
That's nice. And
someone recognized me who I didn't know, came up, was talking NBA, and he said, oh yeah, by the way, you went to college with my cousin. I was like, oh, okay. And that being a guy who was in my fraternity. And he was like, what's he up to? He's like, oh, he's a dentist. And I said, you know what? I've been looking for a new dentist. I used to go to Tend, and I'm just going to air out the grievances very briefly. If you've heard of Tend, they're a New York-based dentistry that roped in a lot of people with some like Netflix partnership and discount codes and whatnot. They're bullshit. They are bullshit artists. They are a business. I was looking to take my dental care elsewhere. And here,
are we sure we shouldn't? I mean, I don't want to be closing off potential ad revenue here, Jake. You know, should we be talking shit about this dentistry business?
I would only be sponsor or in agreement with putting sponsors that I believe in. So okay, don't think we're going to have anyone here.
You're in the market for a new dentist.
So it just seemed like one of those things where the stars aligned. I was like, great, I'm going to reach out to this guy.
My frat brother, and say, put your hands in my mouth.
Jesus Christ. I was going to make another joke, but never mind. So flash forward.
Good. We crushed that one. Let's move on.
We crushed that one. I go to the 20th floor of some building on Madison Avenue on Monday. And it's definitely like a swankier, like there are certain, if you haven't had the pleasure of living in New York City, there are certain old New York Midtown Manhattan buildings that just like scream of old money. And this was one of them. It had, you know, all the Gothic details and the crown molding and blah, 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 to go up and get crown molding in your mouth. Ding, ding, ding. And then my buddy tells me that, oh, this is like his mentor's office that he kindly offers like to him every Monday at one room. Because most of the week he's working for old like Medicare patients and really helping out the people who are really needing the dental care and not necessarily sure. Joe Schmoes like me. So I was like, oh, what does your mentor do? He says, oh, he really, really specializes in like if rich people come in here and say, give me a perfect smile, we can do it all. we can break it all down, we can straighten it up, and we can give you the best veneers possible where they look like real teeth, even though they're fake. I was like, huh, that's interesting. He goes, yeah, his claim to fame is this is the guy who did Walt Frazier's veneers. And I was like, oh, what a great ad campaign, being that those veneers are on MSG Network and on billboards all across the city. Sure. Everyone loves Clyde. So that started my week. Then my mother, who famously announced to me that she was attracted to Jaime Jaquez after we sat on this podcast that I kind of look like him.
Who among us can forget, even with therapy?
Along the lines of Miami, she proceeds to tell me the very next day that in some random golf tournament thing she's doing down there in her snowbirding retirement life, she got paired up with the dentist who is the contractor for the Miami Heat. So there's a lot of NBA dentistry coming around.
Oh my God.
And the one thing I gleaned from that is that LeBron, according to my sources, refused to see this guy. He wanted his own dentist back in the day. The Miami Heat dentist was not good enough for LeBron's megawatt smile, and therefore he is not good enough for me either. That's my tale. And that's all we've got for you today. I don't know
how to respond to that outside of just saying, like, if this results in you getting veneers, like some kind of like on the arm experiential journalism, I got Walt Frazier's veneers and here's live to tell about it. It's going to be hard for me to look at you the same way. Literally, I will be looking at you differently. These are the sacrifices that we make for the content. So look, go with God, Jake. Go get them pearly whites as shiny as possible.
If Yahoo wants to sponsor that endeavor, we can figure it out. We can figure it out. But yeah, that's all we've got for you today on No Cap Room. We thank you for listening. We thank super producer John Gennaro, who does all the things to make the show look and sound great. Please subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you are currently listening on and give us a 5-star review. That would be so, so great. And we'd appreciate it if you came back again next week for another episode of No Cap Room.